is United States against Lloyd. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
Chief Judge Efron, honorable judges of the court, may it please the court. This case revisits the issue of what is the proper standard for demonstrating necessity for expert assistance, particularly in regards to consultation in the forensic science discipline of blood spatter and blood pattern analysis. Our position is that the appellant met the standard, the military judge erred by applying a higher incorrect standard, and we respectfully request this court adopt the framework for review discussed by the dissent in Bresnahan. For clarity, we're not advocating a new standard of review, but rather a revision or redefinition of the terminology. We believe the Bresnahan framework is consistent with how this court has analyzed these cases in the past. It would solve the defense counsel's dilemma, as court noted in Warner. My plan is to begin by discussing some of the facts, how, based on those facts, the appellant met the standard, how the military judge erred, and then, time permitting, discuss the Bresnahan standard. I'll take just a minute to discuss some of the facts. This was a bar fight, 3-on-2. There was no witnesses to the stabbing. None of the victims knew they were stabbed until much later. The knife was never recovered, and no one even saw the knife during the fight. There were only two possible suspects, and as the defense noted in their closing argument, only three possible theories. The appellant committed the stabbings, Mr. Stafford James committed the stabbings, or was a combination of both. Both of them were there, both of them had opportunity, both were involved in the fight. There were specks of blood found in the appellant's shirt in 8 locations, and they were tested for DNA evidence at the U.S.
What have we got here beyond a fishing expedition? We've got a fight, we've got blood, so therefore we must have a blood spatter expert. What is here beyond a kind of Mr. McCauber-ish notion that if we have an expert, maybe something will turn up?
Well, what we have beyond that, Your Honor, is that Eustacil, the government's own expert, said, fish right here. They noted that a blood spatter analysis would be helpful to the defense because the DNA only established that blood was on the shirt, not how it got there. And the government's case hinged on two factors, Mr. James' testimony and the blood analysis. Mr. James' testimony, for what it was worth, he was uncontested the aggressor, he started the fight, and he acknowledged his clothes were soaked in blood, yet he failed to provide a shirt, and the pants he provided were not soaked in blood, but in fact, the specs didn't match blood from anybody in the fight. Two witnesses testified he was untruthful. One said they saw him making a stabbing motion to James.
Well, at trial, what was it that your client asked the military judge or told the military judge that the blood spatter expert would provide?
Two things, Your Honor. To test the government's theory of the case, which was that he stabbed all three of them and that blood evidence was indicative of that, and to explore the theories of the defense, which was that he was not the one to stab the individuals.
But did they say that?
They said to explore the theories and to test the government's case. They, in fact, said...
But what theories did they identify? What defenses did they identify that they thought that the blood spatter expert might help them with?
They did not expressly identify the defense.
And wasn't that one of the problems that the military judge had with the request?
To be honest, ma'am, the military judge's analysis, Your Honor, was left a lot to be desired. She simply said, here's the analysis, you didn't meet it, end of story. So I believe there's some less deference to be provided when she didn't articulate her reasoning. But I believe that the military judge's analysis was less than that. It was simply, you must demonstrate to me that the expert is going to provide favorable evidence before I grant you the expert, which was the dilemma this court noted in Warner.
Is there anything other than paragraph 16 in the motion for appropriate relief? Does that set forth what the grounds for the defense request was?
Paragraphs 15 and 16.
15 and 16.
Which identifies that the case rests upon Mr. James and the blood evidence, and the government's argument is the intuitive nature that the blood on his shirt means that he must have stabbed. So the argument was, it's counterintuitive.
No, he didn't say that.
I'm sorry?
I don't think they said that the blood on the shirt means that he stabbed him. He said, for this reason, the presence of the blood on the clothing may be far less significant than intuition or even the theories that the government intends to explore. It seems to me what they're saying there is what the government is now arguing, that what the blood spatter, well, what they're asking for is the ability to establish that the mere fact that there was blood on his shirt does not mean that he was the stabber.
Yes, Your Honor. Exactly. The fact that the blood was on his shirt does not mean he was a stabber. But conversely, in testing the theories, the other part of that is a question on behalf of the expert. If the government's theory were correct, that he in fact stabbed all three, why does he have only one of the individual's blood on his shirt when the three of them were stabbed? So that's the exploring the theories part. The defense theory was he didn't stab him, he pled not guilty. If he did not stab these three, how is the blood on his shirt other than
the... Now, you've said that very clearly, but you would agree that that's not said with the same specificity in paragraph 16.
Yes, Your Honor, and I would look to McAllister with his court and noted that the defense counsel could have been more articulate, but we have to recognize that when you're dealing with forensic science discipline, a defense counsel is not going to be as...
What does a blood spatter expert know that mere mortal defense counsel do not know?
The way I would categorize this is I call it there's a hard science and soft science component. On the hard science, a blood spatter expert is able to take the physical evidence and try to recreate the scene. That'd be looking at the trails on the blood, doing a mathematical analysis of and microscopic look at the deposits.
Now, was that possible to do in this case, given the fact that the shirt had been cut up already?
It would appear to be possible, but that's not a question we know without asking an expert in this field. Now, Eustacil said they did not believe so, but Eustacil is not an expert in this field. We say that for two reasons. One, they identified analysis could be conducted, and in fact said it would be helpful. But two, they did not conduct the analysis, which begs the question, if they knew it, why didn't they do it? It's akin to a family practice or telling you that, diagnosing a heart condition, you have a cardiologist available. They were not an expert in this field, which is why they did not conduct the analysis. More importantly, in their own report, they said that the cuttings were small, and in some of those blood paints, they only smeared them. So it does not appear that they did any significant damage to the shirt.
I got you sidetracked. You were telling us what the spatter expert consultant might know that defense counsel does not, and you said they can analyze the crime scene. What else? What, I mean, you're in the middle of a sentence, so I want you to finish the sentence.
That's the hard science is trying to recreate. Looking at the testimony, the different variables, the actual evidence in the case, the photos of the evidence in the case. That would be the hard science, the more empirical analysis. It is interpretive, so it factors all the variables. But the other aspect is what I would call the soft science, which is the interpretive. It's testing the government's theory. If he stabbed all three, why is there only blood on one? And to give an example,
But can't the attorney make that argument?
Exactly.
That specific argument, the argument that you just articulated, why can't they make that argument?
They can make that argument, but there's a difference between the silence of evidence and the affirmative evidence. What the defense was allowed to argue.
What about the stipulation of fact?
Yes, ma'am, but that was a testimony from them saying we did not analyze it for this. There's a difference between saying Mr. James could have had a knife and then actually proving with evidence that he in fact must have had it because it's more consistent with the evidence in the case. Defense is only permitted the opportunity to say, we don't know how the blood got on there, but they were denied the opportunity to show it was more consistent with Mr. James stabbing and actually having affirmative evidence of it, not just conjecture.
Counsel, is your theory on appeal in this case that the defense was deprived of the opportunity to present a defense, or is it that the defense was deprived of the opportunity to obtain evidence which may have supported that defense?
More the latter, I believe, Your Honor, because without that consultation, I cannot affirmatively say whether or not the expert would have presented information or not. If there was evidence to support the defense theory that the hard science supported it or even the soft science supported it, they may have had to put on the expert since the government didn't have one at trial that would have presented this testimony. If I can come back for a second to the soft science, had the defense had the consultation, they may have known, for example, the importance of blood on long sleeves. Both Mr. James and the appellant had long sleeve shirts. Having talked to an expert, you might realize that the individual who stabs is most likely to have the blood inside the cuffs of the shirt. That would not be something readily and intuitively important to a defense counsel. But with an expert, the expert would indicate to them that the plausibility of blood inside the cuff from somebody who didn't stab is so far-fetched that it's almost a guarantee.
Now, you figured that out. Did you consult the expert before you came in here today?
In fact, I did. And the notion that I might have questions along those lines, and I did not understand the science myself. So I did ask some questions, but it was also what should an expert see? That was what the defense didn't get the opportunity, was to test the
government. Why couldn't defense counsel put what you just said into paragraph 16?
Perhaps they could have, but we don't know whether the consultant was willing to provide that information. And quite honestly, with all the variables, I'm not sure how forthcoming it
was. With all the variables and in the state of things as they were at trial, how did the judge abuse her discretion?
She applied a standard that appears to say, you need to show to me that the expert's testimony is going to be favorable before you get that consultation. As you noted, Warner, that consultation, said Warner, is oftentimes critical to establishing whether the expert's testimony will be harmful or helpful. And in fact, many of the experts we provide do not end up testifying because it's a risk-benefit analysis of computer forensics and child pornography. They don't end up testifying, but oftentimes are critical to a defense in evaluating the government's case. Same with forensic psychologists, whether or not your client may be a recidivist or have rehabilitation potential. There are a host of scenarios where experts...
Well, if the standard you seem to be espousing is that if we get this guy, maybe he can turn something up, rather than you're saying the judge erred and saying, you got to show me this guy is going to turn something up, then what barriers to getting a consultant in every single case exist?
And the answer, I believe, is falls in the Bresnahan framework. The first prong there is that the defense make a culpable showing that the defense is reasonably available. Although it was the dissent's opinion that referenced this, it was consistent with the majority reasoning. In Bresnahan, the majority reason, the defense had not demonstrated that the defense was reasonably available because they had not shown the individual was sufficiently weak to be susceptible to coercion. So the boundaries, if you will, Your Honor.
Well, it seems to me in a case like this, where you're dealing with blood smears on a cut-up shirt, the threshold you're espousing is awfully low.
Well, this would also depend perhaps on the second prong of this Tiplemans, whether or not a denial would be fundamentally unfair. It's not clear whether that's purely a prejudice analysis or if that's also part of the initial factor, but that would appear to suggest that the evidence is overwhelming, then there are circumstances where you would not get it. If you have a confession and now you're asking for a blood smear expert, under the second prong, that would suggest that you don't get one because the evidence is so compelling. Another notion I wanted to come back to, the question of whether or not there was evidence sufficient for the expert to evaluate. Another factor for the defense of having a consultation, if in fact there was not sufficient evidence for the expert to evaluate, the defense may have had a motion to suppress for failure to preserve evidence. But absent the expert having the opinion that Eustacil cut it up too much and didn't preserve it, the defense had no evidence to make that motion.
What does the record reflect as to who fought whom?
The record reflects that Aaron Soto was fighting the appellant and that Aaron Gee and Jance were fighting Mr. James. Now, there's indication that the fight lasted 30 seconds to a minute, that the blood soaking in the clothes suggests it hadn't been a fair amount of time, and that there was some rolling around between them. Aaron.
Between whom?
Between
all five?
Particularly. Between Mr. James, Aaron Jance, and Aaron Gee, there was some reference that they were rolling around in that particular section. They were on the right side, I'll be clear, and they were just a few feet apart, so it's not impossible for them to have been. In fact, Aaron Soto said they could reach the other individuals. They were that close in the scuffle.
What bearing, if any, do the facts and evidence on the record have on the request, that is, with respect to a case in which there is one individual who is seen with a knife stabbing defined individuals, and there's testimony to that effect. Would the request for a blood spatter expert in that case be viewed in the same light as it would in this case?
What comes to mind is it would depend if the evidence was clear that he'd stabbed all five. If there was a question and the defense could make a culpable showing that it was reasonably available he did not stab all five, perhaps not one, perhaps they would have a basis to argue for consultation. But if there's no reasonable available argument that he didn't stab all five based on the witness, perhaps not.
What about if it were a case of self-defense and the question was whether a blood spatter expert would be helpful in establishing information relevant to that defense? Would that be the same or different?
I would think that might be different because it comes back to recreating the scene and whether or not, based on the hard science, if you will, to the defense, self-defense may have actually played in. But I do caveat that self-defense, often you can lose self-defense at a certain point. If we're talking about bringing a knife to a fist fight, then the argument is if the government hasn't really put that in play, but it may not be valid. But that's where we still have the judges making this call. But with the Bresnahan standard, it seems to not create the defense dilemma that we occasionally see judges apply, particularly with regards to consultation cases.
And you've mentioned Bresnahan, you've mentioned the dissent in Bresnahan. Is there anything in the majority opinion in Bresnahan that you would not rely on at this point?
Nothing comes to mind, Your Honor. I think that because the dissent framework still incorporates a three-part test, that the basis this court has decided many of the expert opinions, denial expert requests, would still fall in the same framework. I don't have any offhand that strikes me from the Bresnahan majority that would be consistent with that.
Does it matter whether it's blood spatter versus false confession versus DNA versus fingerprint versus the hair analysis?
Does it matter in what respect, Your Honor? I can see
as saying. To how the Gonzalez test should be applied.
If there is a difference, I would think it's between the consultation stage and perhaps demanding them to appear at trial as a witness. At the consultation phase, if you meet the colorable showing, then there shouldn't be a difference. If you're dealing with expert witness requests, though, then I think the government may be right to demand not just get a consultation, explain to me why we need to travel and what he's actually going to provide for your trial. It may be a two-part test.
And are some fields more accessible to lawyers than others, or are they all equal?
Yes, sir.
May answer the question.
One of the consistent aspects this court has looked at is interrogation. So when you're dealing with false confessions, I think it was a Freeman's case, that where really is a matter of defense cross-examining the OSI investigators. That's an area where, yes, there are people who specialize in that form, but that is a matter frequently dealt with by defense counsel. So there are areas where I think that would be more questionable. The DNA evidence, forensic science is more complex.
Thank you.
You'll have an opportunity on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Efron, and may it please the court. I am Captain Charles Warner, along with Mr. Roger Reese, who represents the United States in this matter. The military judge did not abuse her discretion in denying what was an unnecessary request for a blood spatter expert in this case, as appellant failed to carry his factual burden to demonstrate a nexus between the expert request and the disputed facts of trial. Accordingly, appellant did not establish a reasonable probability either that an expert would be of actual assistance or that the denial of a blood spatter expert in this case, where the government presented no blood spatter testimony, would deprive him of a fair trial. Your Honors, moving to the first factor of the Gonzalez analysis, which the government...
You're not suggesting that they're only entitled to a consulting expert if the government is going to use a consulting expert, are you? Or if the government's going to put on that specific type of evidence?
No, Your Honor. Obviously, that's not case determinative. It is something that the court can consider. I guess primarily we'd be looking at prejudice there for to what extent the appellant was prevented from presenting a defense theory at trial that was not alleged as a theory of liability by the government.
Well, that's the question that I asked defense, and that is this case about whether the defense was prevented from presenting a theory, or is it a case about whether the defense was prevented from obtaining evidence which might or might not be in support of that theory?
Yes, Your Honor. And in that regard, we would distinguish this case from McAllister. And McAllister, the court held that the denial of the expert denied the appellant the opportunity to present substantive evidence, that is, the test on the two additional genetic strands of, I believe it was PCR, DNA evidence of some sort, that was not conducted by the government expert. Here we have a completely distinct situation. Appellant was not deprived of any evidence in this case. The same DNA evidence that the government relied upon was the DNA evidence provided to appellant. Both sides had experts to evaluate that evidence, and in the stipulation of expected testimony, it's explained and agreed to by appellant, and never disputed at trial, that because of the nature of the DNA testing on the shirt, that the blood spatter analysis was no longer even possible at the time when the appellant's request for a blood spatter expert came in. Also of note, there was no request by appellant below to preserve this evidence, and there's no indication that the government acted in any bad faith and conducting this DNA analysis of the shirt.
So is it your view that the record establishes conclusively that a blood spatter expert could not provide any information of help to the defense in this case?
Well, Your Honor, we would say yes for two reasons. First off, the stipulation of expected testimony, wherein appellants and his counsel explicitly agreed that because of the nature of the shirt and its deconstruction with the DNA analysis, that neither, you know, and the fact that no photographs were taken of the shirt prior to, that a blood spatter analysis wasn't possible. The second reason being that in this case...
Now,
yes, Your Honor.
Read the language that you're relying on.
Yes, Your Honor. And I'm looking here at Joint Appendix, page 211 and paragraph 8, Your Honor. If the shirt had been analyzed by a bloodstain pattern expert prior to collecting cuttings and swabbings for DNA analysis, such an expert may have been able to draw conclusions about the nature of how the blood came to be on the shirt, whether it was smeared, dripped, or was airborne, possibly the distance of travel. Photographs of the shirt could have also allowed a bloodstain expert to examine the evidence after the fact and possibly...
But, and therefore, having an expert at this point could give no guidance as to how blood from only one person ended up on the shirt?
Yes, Your Honor. Based upon the state of the evidence at that time, which was a result not of any government bad faith, but just from typical DNA testing...
Counsel, my question to you...
Yes, Your Honor.
...was whether the record established conclusively that there would be no evidence that a blood spatter expert could present based upon the state of the evidence in the case. The material you've referred to describes what could have been done beforehand. Where in that or other part does it say that a blood spatter expert could not have done an examination and presentation of evidence in this case at the stage at which the evidence existed at the time such an investigation could have taken place?
Your Honor, the government would argue that taking the stipulation of expected testimony in tandem with the defense's motion to compel an expert, in which they had a factual burden to raise, to demonstrate what assistance the expert could provide, the explication of methods and resources and testing procedures was completely absent.
That's a different argument. I understand that argument. That your argument is that the defense didn't carry a burden. My question was whether the record established that the defense was precluded from carrying its burden. That's different from saying that the defense didn't present enough to carry its burden.
Yes, Your Honor. And we have to understand the distinction. I guess the government's point is that if those methods had been available, that the defense would have pled those in its motion to compel, as it was aware of the Gonzalez factors, that would be, in fact, its factual burden.
Well, counsel, my question, I guess, is in deciding the issue in this case, are we looking at what was in the motion, or are we looking at it in light of what we think we now could have put in the motion based on the record?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. In evaluating whether the military judge abused her discretion in granting this request, the government respectfully submits that it's the record before the military judge at the time the motion was made that is determinative to the court in evaluating whether her findings of fact were clearly erroneous and whether her conclusions of law were in error. Here, there simply was no factual record made by the appellant in his request. All that we have in the request is a recital of facts about when charges were preferred, when the initial expert request was put in, two lines, literally, that they think the government would rely on blood spatter at trial, and then a recital, pardon me, Your Honor, recital of the standard for granting an expert and just a blanket assertion that we need one and don't have proper training in blood spatter. There was no factual discussion of how a blood spatter expert could be available in this case. In fact, the facts before the military judge were only that a charge had been preferred. There was no facts about a second stabber, no facts about the proximity of the parties, no facts about whether anyone else had been seen with a knife. There was simply the appellant asking the military judge to fly blind and make a presumption that blood spatter expert testimony could be relevant when there was no indication that anyone other than appellant for her might have had a knife, and therefore any other explanation how blood may have splattered on him other than that he was a stabber. In this way, we would analogize this case to the court's decision in Bresnahan, where the court found that no false confessions expert was applicable because there was no factual nexus between the particular circumstances of that appellant and the false confession expert that he alleged in this case. There was no showing that he was particularly submissive or that there were coercive techniques involved. And that burden, that factual burden, is the burden on the appellant, Your Honor.
Do you think it's within the ordinary knowledge of defense counsel to know how far blood spatters from wounds?
Pardon, Your Honor, do I think it's been the
normal? Did normal counsel know that?
Perhaps not, Your Honor. I don't know that. I would imagine that most counsel don't have that information readily at their fingertips. Yes, Your Honor.
And how much blood, where was the blood from on this guy's shirt?
Your Honor, it was located on the front of the appellant's shirt.
And whose blood was it?
It was Senior Airman Jance's blood, Your Honor.
And he's accused of stabbing three people, right?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
And so one of the mysteries here is why there was blood from one person but not the other two on the shirt?
Yes, Your Honor.
And is it your contention that a blood spatter expert might not provide some guidance onto that? Or is it your contention they just didn't make the case?
Your Honor, it's our contention that they just didn't make the case. Obviously, there could have been a circumstance where appellant brought forward something, an 1168, an excerpt from the ROI, a synopsis of expected testimony.
Now, is the fact that there are three people stabbed and there was only blood from the one person on the shirt before the judge when she made the determination?
No, Your Honor.
So she didn't know that he had been charged with stabbing three people? That wasn't within her knowledge? She thought she was doing a rape case or something?
No, Your Honor, she did know that he'd been stabbed. The appellant had been accused of stabbing three people. The defense did recite the charges in their expert request. What she did not have before her was the use of civil report that was available to the defense to offer in. Again, any statement 1168 preserved from the Article 32 in the case or any other factual.
Did the judge know or not that there was blood only from one person on the shirt?
Your Honor, and
for the purposes of her ruling.
Yes, Your Honor.
It's not a trick question. I want what the answer is.
Yes, Your Honor. For the purposes of her ruling, I don't believe that the closest knowledge of the military judge came was the defense's recital that it's anticipated there will be testimony and trial regarding the location of blood spatter on a T-shirt allegedly worn by Senior Airman Lloyd. There was no description of whose blood was on the T-shirt, how many persons.
Well, counsel, because I would just urge you to be careful, because at times it appears that you're arguing that there's no way a blood spatter expert could have been used to the defense in this case, and it seems to me that's not the issue before us.
Yes, Your Honor, to be clear, it's our position that under the facts is available to the military judge, as presented, or the lack thereof, as presented by appellant in this case, that there was no reasonable nexus that the military judge could rely on to find a necessity for a blood spatter expert in this case. It was a deficient factual record that prevented appellant from receiving the help of an expert here that they just failed to demonstrate was necessary.
Counsel, I think you made the statement earlier in your argument that the defense never made a request that the government preserve this evidence, preserve the shirt.
Yes, Your Honor.
How significant is that? I mean, what does that matter at this point?
Well, Your Honor, in McAllister, it was significant in my interpretation of McAllister, where the defense counsel had, similar to this case, received DNA results from their client and made a timely request to preserve that, because they had done additional research and discovered that there may be additional testing that could be conducted in this case.
But what are the timelines in this case? When was the request, or when was the shirt sent in for the DNA testing? In my reading, and it's a little bit hazy, it appears that's before this guy was even charged.
Yes, Your Honor.
So how in the world can he request that something be preserved before he's even charged?
Yes, Your Honor. If that timeline is correct, then the preservation of the shirt afterwards, we would agree. It would have less of a factor. I guess the point the government wants to emphasize, there was no bad faith in misconduct by the government in failing to preserve this evidence, where it was just acting in accordance with normal forensic investigative activity.
But you can't fault the defense for not requesting that it be preserved when, at that point, he's not technically a defendant.
Yes, Your Honor, we agree with that proposition as far as it goes. Now, Your Honor, also we would hold that the military judge was correct in holding that there was no necessity for an expert in this case.
Counsel, did the military judge say anything other than just recite the law? What facts did the military judge rely on in this case, at least in terms of what's articulated in the military judge's findings of fact or conclusions of law? I see the assertions and the conclusions, conclusory statements in there. They may or may not be correct. But where does the judge grapple with the evidence that was presented in the defense proffer and address it in this case? Or where does the judge discuss any evidence in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. In response to that, the government would merely assert that the military judge was compelled to stick with the facts that were presented her by the parties. And here, since there were no facts presented her by the appellant, so to the extent that the military judge's findings of fact are bereft of detail, that is the responsibility of the appellant to come to raise those factual issues to her in the first instance. The military judge does not have a sua sponte duty to seek out additional facts, and the adversarial system is the responsibility of the parties to bring those to her attention, particularly where it's within the appellant's burden to show reasonable necessity for this expert. And, Your Honor, in that respect as well, in returning to the abuse of discretion standard, the court has held that, particularly in McAllister, which appellant relies upon, the abuse of discretion laid there because the DNA evidence was the linchpin of that case. In this case, the linchpin of appellant's case is recited by defense counsel below in argument, and that's Joint Appendix at 177, and in appellate defense counsel in brief, and that's at page 17, was Mr. James's credibility. The DNA evidence here was relied upon, was so important that the government relegated it to a stipulation of expected testimony rather than live testimony, and mentioned it in a full one paragraph of 12 pages of argument. The linchpin of this case was the confession of appellant to Mr. James, surrounded by the corroborating evidence of appellant being the only one with access to the knife, the relative positioning of the parties, and the insertion of the
staff. Well, the government certainly argued the presence of the blood on the shirt at some length, didn't it?
Respectfully, Your Honor, our reading of the record was that in findings that was not the case. Senior trial counsel argued one paragraph about, and whose blood do you see on the shirt? You might expect it to be Soto. That's what he was wrestling with. In fact, no, it was Senior Aaron Jance in eight places, and then moved on and discussed. It was their theory of the case was that appellant was able to stab Senior Airman Jance and Senior Airman G after Senior Airman Soto jumped off of him and gave appellant access to come up and stab him from behind. If there are no further questions, may I briefly conclude? Your Honor, the military judge did not abuse her discretion in this case, as the DNA evidence at issue was not the linchpin of the case and not necessary to present a defense. Appellant had a full opportunity to present his defense in this case, as demonstrated through the stipulation of expected testimony that embedded his theory that the DNA only discussed the location of appellant to the crime rather than him as stabber, their opportunity to cross-examine Mr. James and undermine his credibility, and the full presentation of their theory to the members at argument. As such, the military judge was both correct in her denial of an unnecessary expert, and even if incorrect, there was no prejudice in this case to appellant's opportunity to present his theory of the case. The appellant was deprived of no opportunity to preserve evidence, that issue was rendered moot by the earlier DNA testing of the shirt. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Briefly on two points I wanted to follow up on. One was whether there were limitations on analysis. I want to reference that this court and Lee had a particular issue with requiring the defense to rely upon the government's expert's opinion of its own limitations. And this, again, would be a similar case where the use of cylinder is not capable of analyzing it, and to rest upon their non-expert opinion as to whether a real expert could have analyzed it would not be fair to the defense, same as it was in Lee. The other big issue I wanted to point to was on the facts presented to the judge. It was, in fact, Your Honor, on the motion forward to compel in paragraph 2, the defense did place before the judge the DNA analysis of the blood. All eight spatters concluded the blood on the shirt belonged to Mr. Christopher Jance. So the judge had the charges that there were three victims, but that the facts that she adopted for her own in her motion said only blood was only from one of those individuals. The defense then in their argument also noted that the government is going to argue guilt in alleged victims. One alleged victim's blood on the shirt is being evidence of the guilt, but that's counterintuitive, and we need the expert assistance to explain that.
Counsel, as I understand at least part of the government's argument, it's that we should not at this point take the evidence of record at trial that was developed after the motion and look back, and that is all the evidence that's raising questions about a possible alternative perpetrator in this case and the different locations of the blood were matters that should have been presented to the military judge at the time of the motion, and that it's not appropriate for us to look at that now. What's your response to that position?
I point to McAllister 1, because of the two. This is the 2001. There was a quote, "Well, defense counsel was not as articulate as we would like in explaining why it is clear from the record as a whole that the defense expert needed assistance in this technical area." So at least McAllister appears the court took the look at as a whole and did not fault the defense counsel for not being as articulate as perhaps it could have been, similar to this case. Unless there are other questions, I'll briefly conclude. The appellant was denied a fair trial. He requested expert assistance so he'd have the tools to test the government's theory and establish his innocence. The military judge erred in denying his request. The error was not harmless. We respectfully request this court reverse the CCA, set aside the charges and specifications, and adopt the framework for review discussed by the President.
Thank you, counsel. We thank both counsel for your presentation today. The case is now submitted, and the court will be in recess until 10:15 a.m.
Thank you.